This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by Siemens.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Evan Halper. I cover the energy transition here at the Post. We have two segments for you today on the race to decarbonize. We'll be talking with Birger Steen, who's the CEO of Freyr Battery, a manufacturer. But first, we'll welcome Congressman Scott Peters, a Democrat from California and chair of the Climate Change and Clean Energy Task Force. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks. Good to be with you today.
Let's start talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. As this video mentioned, it's a $400 billion package. It's the president's signature climate bill, yet few Americans know about it. Polls show something like 70% have heard little to nothing about the bill. So let's open by talking about what they should know and maybe tell us a little about why so few Americans are aware of what this big package is.
Well, it is, as the president said in the video clip you said, the biggest investment in climate action in the history of the world by any countries, by our country or by any country, and provides a lot of money to support the kinds of things we need to move away from reliance, such a heavy reliance on fossil fuels. That's in form of incentives, but in a lot of forms of grants, support for investments, and actual dollars for things like everything from charging stations to offshore wind, solar, utility scale solar. I think the reason that maybe people don't know about it as much is that it's hard to get a big program like that off the ground. And, we got a lot of work to do, as I said, to make it go faster. I love that, by the way, that the discussion is captioned the race to decarbonize, because we should think of it as a race. You know, we've been saying we need to do this within 10 years, make the big decisions within 10 years, but that's not possible under the current laws that we have affecting permitting and the way Congress is used to going so slow.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk about how things are going. I mean, this bill was signed into law in August of 2022, I believe. A lot of money has gone out the door since then. What's going well? What's working? What changes have we seen as a result of the bill?
Well, we had record deployment of solar wind in 2023, but we're still getting dwarfed by China. The point is, we've got to, if you look at what's going to happen with the demand, which is going to go up by staggering amounts, and the condition of our grid right now, we have to basically triple the size of the grid within 30 years. Took 150 years to build this grid. Today, we take about 10 years to build one interregional transmission line. So what's not going well is that we're just not building out the infrastructure we need to make this transition. Just for point of reference, since 2014, North America has built 7 gigawatts of interregional transmission. Just use that as a framework, a little less than half of that's the United States, so say 4 in the United States. In South America, the comparable number is 22 gigawatts. In Europe, 44 gigawatts. In China, 260 gigawatts of interregional transmission. We're just not going to be able to compete at this rate. So we've got to figure out ways to make things go faster, from permitting to litigation to everything. We say it's a crisis. We say it's a race. But we're not acting like that yet. We've got all the resources we need. We just got to make it happen faster.
So speaking of the grid, it seems like we've had a wake-up call in the last few months with the amount of demand that all of these states are reporting. They were expecting that there'd be a lot of demand. They were expecting that the grid was going to be taxed and we needed to build more. But suddenly data centers are getting built. Some of the clean energy factories we're talking about with the Inflation Reduction Act. And places are on a path to run out of power. Were you surprised by the levels of demand, and you know, do we need to start changing policy quicker than even you anticipated?
Well, you know, it's a credit to President Biden that we have this demand. I mean, the increase in heavy manufacturing. We want to build chips here. We want to reinvigorate manufacturing here. That takes a lot of power, so I know we know it's coming. The other thing that's happened, we've seen the grid fail in extreme weather events. Cold weather and and hot weather because of demand. We have a wake up call right now from climate. We've seen on the ground that the grid is just antiquated and insufficient and needs to be built out. There's I can't remember how many gigawatts, 2,000 gigawatts of power wanting to be hooked up to interconnections to the grid. They're all waiting in line. 95% of those are clean. If we make everything go faster, it's a win for the climate. And I think we have a growing understanding about that in the public and in the Congress, but it's just so hard to get away from the way we've always done things before.
Yeah, I think that's an important point you raise about what they call the interconnection queue, I guess. There's projects, there's solar projects, there's wind projects, there's all of this development of renewable energy, and the wait time to hook into the grid has just grown longer and longer. In some cases, it's years, right? And so that being the case, this is not so much a generation problem or a problem of creating more power, although that is a challenge, and all these utilities are looking to bring more fossil energy on because it's easier and quicker, and the grid was built for that. But to modernize the grid in the way you're talking about, you have a plan for that, along with other lawmakers. So let's talk about your legislation. Tell us what it is and what it would do and the changes that would need to be made.
Well, there's a few things. One is we've got to be able to site these new lines more quickly. So I wrote a bill called the Power On Act that was included in the bipartisan infrastructure bill, 2 years now ago, to give the FERC, the Regulatory Commission, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, what we call backstop authority, so that if states aren't building out interregional transmission lines that go from one region to another, then the FERC will have more authority. I've introduced the FASTER Act to enhance that authority, give better permission to FERC to take power, to facilitate the cooperation with communities to make this go faster. That's one thing. We also want to support the notion of interregional transmission with a minimum transfer requirement. So because of the need for resiliency, because we want more competition and better costs, Senator Hickenlooper and I have introduced something called the Big Wires Act. That would require a minimum transfer of 30% of your power, the ability to transfer up to 30% of your power from one region to another. That's going to provide more resiliency for the grid, more on-demand, the ability to respond to more on time-sensitive ability to respond to demand, and provide better cost competition for consumers, potentially lower costs. In general, we have to figure out how to pay for that. So there's a lot of discussions about how to allocate costs from the communities that are generating power to the communities that are receiving it and to the communities in between that will be hosting the wires. Those are the things we have to discuss. And I wish discussions were going faster, but I think the issues are becoming better understood.
So when you talk about the power grid, things get very wonky very fast, and it's something that a lot of people don't have a sort of good understanding of, because it's something we all take for granted, right? You expect you're going to turn on the power, it'll be there. These outages are a fairly new thing for most of us and are making us wake up and realize, okay, we can't really take this for granted. But when you talk about the plan to fix it, it sounds pretty straightforward and bureaucratic, you know, resiliency, transmission. Let's unpack why this is so complicated and why these things are not happening, and why, as you alluded to before, the amount of power line that we're building or transmission lines we're building is just so much less than it was in the past. So a big challenge here, I assume, is community opposition, right? And your bill has to straddle the line of, what rights the government, the utilities have to just start building these power lines. How do you handle environmental review? How big of a sticking point are those tensions in trying to move forward with improvements to the grid?
Well, there are a lot of obstacles. I mean, if this were easy, it would be done, because the demand would draw the investment, right? First, you have to understand that our grid is set up in these regions that aren't particularly incentivized to work with each other. And so, most utilities are thinking of their own territory. They're not so concerned, but they want to spend money connecting outside the territory. That's an incentive we've got to deal with. FERC, the Regulatory Commission, is good at giving permission. They could be better at giving permission. But, you know, they're often disincentivized to actually, we can give them all the power in the world, but if they don't want to act, maybe they need some incentive to actually be more aggressive. And then, yeah, from community to community, you've got to prove that this is something that's useful to folks and that it's something that they're going to tolerate. Often you have to compensate them for hosting these power lines. And there's ways to make those deals that are feasible. We've seen that happen throughout the country. There's good models for that. And then you've got litigation at the end of the day. We have a law called the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, that all it was supposed to do is give direction to the government that before you make a decision that could affect the environment, government, you have to consider those impacts, you have to consider all the alternatives, and then go forward with your decision. But it's become the most litigated of all the environmental laws. And when a lawsuit takes 4 years, that's a lot of the reason why when you want to build a power line, it takes 10 years to build an regional power line. Only 3 years is construction. We've got 7 years of process in there. And that's a huge issue that we've got to take on. And the point I make too today is, you know, when NEPA was passed and was signed into law, like the first days of 1970, the environmental movement was on defense. We were trying to stop bad things from happening. And NEPA was a good way to slow things down and make sure that all the issues were considered. But now we're on offense. To deal with climate action, it's about building transmission. It's about building offshore wind, utility scale solar, hydrogen pipelines, direct air capture. And we as environmentalists have to be aggressive about building things. We've got environmental laws, ironically, that slow things down. And we've got to modernize those laws to deal with today's challenges. We need that to happen in Congress, but we need support from the outside as well, from the president and from the environmental groups, frankly, many of whom are nervous about making those changes.
Yeah, let's talk about the tensions of environmental groups and why they're nervous. Because as you're alluding to, getting solar farms built, getting wind farms built, that's something you would think, you know, these groups that are talking about climate change, they're talking about the need to meet the goals in the Paris Agreement on climate change, or they're just necessary, they're all crucial. But at the same time, we're seeing environmental groups really uneasy about the amount of land that's being used, about what this means for, habitats. How are you working through those tensions, you know, amongst not tensions between the left and the right, but tensions amongst environmental groups themselves?
Well, I mean, to underscore the problem slowly, so on the right, when I came in, it was pretty common to have climate deniers and people who denied that climate change was happening. There's been some movement on the right with the Conservative Climate Caucus and John Curtis starting this caucus with 80 people who say, as Republicans, climate change is happening and it's due to human activity. On the left, what we have is a trade-off denial. I mean, I think the problem is that we have to understand that this is not going to be perfect. It's going to be hard, that there are trades we have to make to protect the climate. And we can't let perfect be the enemy of the good. But these laws were written in 1970. They're not written by Moses. They're not on stone tablets. They're written by people like us who were trying to solve the problems of the day. And we need leadership to solve those problems today, to solve today's problems. And today's problems are really clued these laws that slow us down in climate action. So, I've had people just tell me you can't touch NEPA. It's a so-called bedrock environmental law. It is not. It's not the Clean Air Act. It's not the Clean Water Act. It's not a law that actually regulates pollution into the environment. It's a planning law. We have to plan differently. So we need to make sure that NEPA disputes are not 4 years, they're 4 months. And there's ways to do that that I think we should pursue as environmentalists. We're not talking about trying to open the field for coal plants. 95% of, as I said, of the projects that want to get connected to the grid are clean. So if we make things go faster, it's good for us. And anyone would trade 5 to get 95. That's a good deal. So we should just get on with it.
You mentioned the need to incentivize, if I heard you right, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which is sort of this obscure board. Again, not many of us really understand or know about or understand how it functions, but has some regulatory authority over this kind of confusing patchwork of electricity systems that we call the power grid. How do you incentivize them? I mean, my understanding is they have limited authority to actually push projects through, and a lot of this happens in the states. So what role do they play as referee to get some of these projects moving forward, and how can they be more proactive?
Well, there's good work happening right now on giving FERC more authority. By the way, the FERC is supposed to have 5 commissioners. I think we're down to 3. And we need to appoint that so that they have a quorum and they can act. But once we give them the authority that they need to make sure that they're more than just a referee, but they're an actor, we're going to have an administration that's willing to act. And that'll be the next step, is that, it's hard for bureaucracies to take on these issues. You come into contact with people who are voters. Voters call the representatives and their senators. And that's something that tends to shut down a bureaucracy. We're going to need a more active FERC, and that's going to come from presidential leadership. But first, it's on Congress to give them the authority that they need to make these things happen. So we've got a notion that we're going to do these national corridors, transmission corridors, which is great. You can draw them on a map. You can wait for the states to come to an agreement. If they don't come to an agreement, you can issue the permit yourself. And I think that's the thing that FERC's going to have to step into that gap a little bit more than they have in the past. They'll need the power to do it, and then they'll need the will to do it.
And in terms of the power to do it, I mean, are we talking about giving them authority to actually move some of these projects along, and that the federal government should have authority to, after the process goes on a few months, just say this needs to happen and this landowner can't stand in the way any further, or is that going a step too far?
No, that's actually the point of the FASTER Act that I've introduced with Rep. Vesey and Cardenas and Senator Heinrich. I think that's the idea, is, we need to make sure that if states don't do this job, because we generally have delegated this to the states, and the state regulators know a lot about it, and the utilities are regional, but we have a national interest in this. If the states can't pull it off, the federal government's got to stop in and do it. And I think that's where we'd like to head.
So much more to talk about on these issues, but afraid we are running out of time. Congressman Peters, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post Newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
Hello, my name is Christian Bell, and I have the pleasure of heading the equity investment team in the Americas for Siemens Financial Services. A core part of our strategy at Siemens is increasing the speed and scale of decarbonization. Of course, key to this is reducing emissions in the first place. But another critical priority is removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is why Siemens announced its first investment in Carbon Capture Inc., which is our first in direct air capture in the U.S. Direct air capture is critical for addressing the carbon dioxide already in our atmosphere and to reducing long-term climate change impacts. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Adrian Corliss, the CEO of Carbon Capture, Inc. Carbon Capture is developing modular and scalable direct air capture systems. Adrian, thank you for joining us on the Washington Post Live.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
The U.S. is already making great strides to be the proving ground for new carbon capture technologies. For the past few years, there's been an important focus on accelerating the energy transition to more renewable sources. The conversation has now expanded to include the importance of carbon capture. At this point, it's about the math behind how we get to net zero by 2050. Adrian, maybe we start with what direct air capture is and where does it fit into the world of carbon management?
Great, thanks, Christian. And first of all, you're absolutely correct. It is about the math. And the reality is that we have this non-negotiable 40 billion ton of carbon challenge that we have to address. And I think that when we look at that, it's not going to be enough to think about reducing emissions and deploying renewables, et cetera. Consensus is we're going to need between 5 and 10 billion tons a year of carbon removal to get to net zero. So what is direct air capture? I mean, direct air capture is an engineered approach to removing CO2 that's already up in the atmosphere. And so when we think about direct air capture, it's considered in some ways to be the, you know, the gold standard or basically the, you know, the way to do carbon removal that is the, you know, both verifiable, it's permanent, and also it's additional. So I think that in all those ways, you know, it's important to think about direct air capture as again the way that we can go about this, which is really the gold standard. And so beyond that, you know, direct air capture is a versatile piece of technology. And the thing that's interesting is that it can be also used to take CO2 to the atmosphere as a feedstock for things like sustainable aviation fuels, for things like concrete or other chemicals. So it's really, from that perspective, an important part of getting to net zero. Now, having said that, and despite all of its advantages, you know, direct air capture is today very expensive, and it is really limited in scale and in supply. So we have a long ways to go.
That's interesting, Adrian. We know government can play an important role in helping nascent technologies and industry develop and scale. The U.S. is demonstrating true leadership on climate through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, Inflation Reduction Act, and the innovative programs run by the Department of Energy's Fossil Fuel Office of Fossil Fuel Energy and Carbon Management. The $3.5 billion regional DAC hub program and the more recent announcement by the federal government to directly procure CO2 removal are all part of a broad strategy. Adrian, how do these initiatives help support the industry's development?
So first of all, I want to say that, you know, we firmly believe that the nation's goal of getting to $100 a ton for direct air capture removal of CO2 is attainable. But getting there is going to require both a combination of innovation and also a commitment to the rapid scale up of the industry. So U.S. programs like the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law or the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, they are important because they are really, you know, opportunities to kickstart this industry and really to start to take advantage of the substantial cost savings that we know will happen from learning by doing, where we know that, you know, cumulative experience is going to drive down cost. In some ways, you can think about these programs as down payments to get the industry started and really attract the capital that's going to be essential to get this industry going. I would say right now the U.S. has set the standard in terms of support. And I think that, you know, what we'll see is, you know, Europe and other parts of the world are going to step up and follow suit. And I think that's important because time really isn't on our side. You know, we're going to need this to be a global effort to be successful.
Thank you. So it seems clear that it will take various initiatives and an ecosystem of players to support the carbon capture industry's development. What role do strategic investors like us here at Siemens Financial Services play in helping complement the carbon capture ecosystem beyond just providing capital?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, you know, removing billions of tons of CO2 from the atmosphere is a huge challenge. And I think that, you know, it's beyond what an individual technology company could ever do on its own. So it's going to require significant technical innovation and the deployment of significant amounts of capital. From our point of view, you know, we think that, you know, strategics in general are going to be a key part of supply of both, and that we need to create this large tent where we really are, you know, attracting the industrial community to help, you know, basically resolve and approach this problem with us. Now, when we think specifically about Siemens Financial and Siemens in general, I mean, they're a unique organization in that they bring to the table this portfolio of technologies, you know, around energy, around infrastructure, around advanced controls, automation, and digital twins. I think that are going to allow us to think about how we accelerate the deployment of technology. So I think that's where, you know, Siemens comes in specifically. I think Siemens also, you know, and companies like Siemens are going to, you know, be important customers to us as well too. So we know that Siemens is going to do everything that it can to tackle their direct emissions and approach net zero, you know, in the time frame that they've committed. But I think that, you know, the really hard to abate components of their industry are going to require carbon removal. And I think that, you know, partnering with Siemens, you know, is important for us. And I think being part of that Siemens solution in terms of getting to net zero is part of our mission and part of the reason why we're really excited to be partnering with you. And so I think from that perspective, again, you know, like Siemens is going to be central to our success.
Thank you, Adrian. Appreciate that. We are very proud to work with companies like yours that share our vision for building a sustainable future. I mean, you and your team are advancing very important work, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Christian. I really appreciate the conversation and grateful for your ongoing support.
Likewise, thank you. And with that, I'll turn it back to the Washington Post.
And now, back to Washington Post Live.
Welcome back to Washington Post Live. I'm Evan Halper, a reporter covering the energy transition here at the Post. We'll be joined now by Birger Steen, who's CEO of Freyr Battery. Birger, welcome to Washington Post Live.
Evan, thanks. It's great to be here.
So batteries, it's something not many of us know about. It's going to become a lot more important in our lives as we move forward with the energy transition. You know, these are not just batteries we're using in our, you know, personal devices, but now they're in our cars, and soon we may be using them to get power off the grid. Tell us about the kind of battery that you're working on and what you're manufacturing.
Yeah, so Freyr Battery was started soon to be 6 years ago in order to decarbonize energy storage and transportation by producing the world's cleanest batteries. And we started that mission here in Norway. In fact, I'm speaking to you now from Mo i Rana, which is the north of the country, just about where the Arctic Circle intersects the Norwegian coastline. And we built here what you see behind us, which is our customer qualification plant, where we demonstrate that you can scale to gigawatt hour production scale the 24M semi-solar technology, which we licensed off of 24M spin-out from MIT. The battery cells we're making here are intended primarily to be used in the grid, electricity grid. So they could sit next to a PV solar farm, they could sit next to a wind farm, they could sit in the grid to help balance and to help prevent some of the problems we just heard about in the first part of the program. And they could also sit at the consumer or user side. So anyone who's got sort of an air conditioner or anything in their house that they want to make sure they buy power when it's cheap and not exactly when they need it, or also industrial users and others. So that's going to be the primary usage of our battery cells, which are lithium iron cells, but they could also go into EVs and buses and trucks. Ferries is a big thing here in Norway and other forms of transportation.
Let's break down a little bit more on how they work with the electricity system and with the grid, because we're seeing, especially in parts of the United States that are experiencing outages or difficulties in periods of peak demand and extreme weather, that batteries are suddenly over the last couple of years playing a much bigger role than I think those of us who are not in the industry had anticipated. So in the case of a battery, you're talking about it stores the electricity or the energy from a solar operation or a wind operation. And when the wind's not blowing, the sun's not shining, you can have all that energy in the battery, and then you can put it back on the grid when, you know, suddenly the system is overtaxed. That's my understanding of how this works. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So if you're a producer sourcing intermittent electricity from solar or wind, you'd typically like to be able to sell that that power into the grid either at a relatively even rate or even, as we talked about before, when you get paid for it and not when you produce it. So for that reason, you'll typically build these quite large battery storage facilities that they will look like the 20-foot freight container, or many of them rather, that are lined up next to your facility or in the vicinity. So that would be the source usage of these batteries. Then you could also put them in where you have choke points in the net. So we've talked about this inter-regional electricity transmission before. And so having an ability to store electricity at those types of choke points could help reduce the need to build out transmission capacity if it's specifically to deal with short-term fluctuations or choke point situations.
So it's interesting, you're a Norwegian-based company, and obviously Norway is a place where there's the country's really out front in terms of electrification. The number of electric cars that people are buying as a percentage of cars they buy, the decarbonization of the power grid there. But you're moving to the U.S. with this plant. So tell us about what motivated you to actually relocate and do this production in the United States.
Yeah, no, as you point out, here in Norway, the 2023 car sales with 84% EVs, and our power grid today is fully sustainable in the sense that it's all hydropower, and then increasingly becoming now more wind as well. We started building FREYR in Norway partly because there's a strong support for it, partly also because we had the opportunity to use that clean power and also a very industry-friendly environment up here in Mo i Rana. It's a city with industry traditions dating back to the energy minings, the Edison mining syndicate that started up here in 1906. So those were all good reasons to start here. However, as we were part through the construction of our first plant here, first gigafactory, we'd also secured land in both in Finland and in Kuwaita, Georgia, to start up later. The IRA was passed, and we spent some time working with the Norwegian government, European governments, or European Union, to see if there would be a policy level response that could allow us to continue here. But we concluded last year that the attractiveness of the IRA in terms of producing or providing, you could call non-dilutive growth capital. So capital that helps you scale in that crucial phase where you have a technology, you have a plant, but you're trying to catch up with competitors that have had the last 10 or 15 years to build cumulative production volume and then sort of driving down the learning curve. That benefit in the IRA was just too compelling. So we flipped our plan. We are now going first for construction in Kuwaita, Georgia. And we also re-domiciled partly as a consequence of this. So our company is now listed in New York and domiciled in the US. And our first plant is going to be built in Kuwaita, Georgia.
So not just the United States, but you're going to Georgia, which is part of an interesting story where a lot of these clean manufacturing plants are opening in red states, despite it's a politically interesting story here in the U.S., despite the opposition from a lot of red state lawmakers to these subsidies. Tell us about Georgia, why that particular state, why you decided to locate there.
Well, it's attractive for many reasons. I mean, one thing is that building up capability, capacity, competitiveness in this new industry is going to require quite a bit of global talent and travel. So we're right south of Hartsfield. That's one biggest airport in the world. Very important. More importantly, though, the local population is growing. There is a strong education system, and here in Norway we're already partnering with the educational system from the Battery Academy up here at the local high school, so trade school level kids who want to get started on a professional or career as perhaps operators, very well paid jobs, skilled jobs that you can get right out of high school, all the way up to postdoc. We have more than a dozen doctorates that we have sponsored at the local university. So that kind of environment, we can do that, we found in Georgia and particularly in Kuwaita. And so we're going to continue to invest in that going forward. We also got a reception that speaks, just as we had here in Mo i Rana, a very industry-friendly and an appreciative environment. We found that in Kuwaita, Georgia as well. So far had a great great partnership both with the city and the county and good relations with the state government as well.
You mentioned re-domiciling part of your company. Was that driven by provisions in the IRA that say you need to be an American company to benefit from some of these incentives, or what was the thinking there? And what are the particular incentives in the IRA that most motivated you to locate in Georgia?
Yeah, so re-domiciling was not particularly driven by the IRA. We actually, as a European company, we had access to the IRA already, and there, as far as we're aware, there's no movement towards limiting that for European companies. We have other people in the business that are building in the U.S. and are still domiciled over here. But as a New York Stock Exchange listed company, we simply got access. We will get access and are getting access to a larger universe of investors by being a U.S. company listed in New York. So that's perhaps the main reason for that. Although I think it's also a simpler story to tell. Our main market and the core of our effort right now is going into the U.S. So it's a much more straightforward story to tell. Now, the IRA, and this is something we've been talking to European policymakers about, local policymakers, is it has this particular feature which I referred to earlier as non-dilutive growth capital. So you get the major part of the benefit, the production tax credits, which are quite significant relative to the underlying variable cost of producing battery cells. You get access to it as you actually sell your product. So it's not about picking winners the way much industrial policy has been. And nor is it about sustaining an industry that's at the end of its life. It's actually support right when you need it at that scale phase. So as you've built your factory, you're already a winner because building a battery factory is a difficult thing. You're starting to produce at gigascale and then you get the support as you learn and as you try to catch up with competitors in other parts of the world that have been at this for much longer. And then it fades. So there's actually a time incentive built into it. Because as it fades out in 2031, 32, you have to be standing on your own 2 feet. And so there, we just think there's several really, really clever ways of attracting private capital and to really accelerate that movement at the time when we need it the most, as we just heard from the senator.
Is the support coming in the form of tax incentives? Is it more direct subsidies? Or what kind of specific support do you get as you start to hit these benchmarks?
Yeah, specific to the IRA for battery cell production, production tax credits are $35 per kilowatt hours of produced battery cells or produced and sold battery cells. And the cost of producing a battery cell is probably in the West in the vicinity of $80 now. We see in the Chinese market, we see quotes that are, or we see companies that are talking about production costs below 50, because they've been at this for a lot longer. 97% of the LFP production capacity, so lithium iron phosphate battery cell production capacity in the world is in China. The $35 basically goes to defray the cost of starting out earlier on the learning curve. And for those critical years between now and 2032.
And when it comes to competing with China, because this has been an issue, obviously, that drove the passage of the IRA, and a lot of companies are dealing with as they make use of this tool to build factories. Does it inhibit you from using any Chinese technology? Are you able to, are some of the technology you need not available outside of China? Or how much are you able to integrate anything you need from China into what you're doing in the US, or are they completely cut out of the picture?
No, this is a really interesting question, and it's an important question because we're talking about development in East Asia generally, and in China specifically. That's been, it's been an official target, and it's been quite consistent over the last 15 to 20 years. So you probably wouldn't call this a Sputnik moment because it's been going on for a long time. But it is a situation where we in the West are significantly behind in terms of capability and capacity. So it's going to be important that anybody who's participating in this gets to learn and gets to use the technologies and yet gets to compete. And so in the current implementation of the IRA, there are limitations, and I think there's foreseen that there might be some more limitations in terms of direct ownership and such. We don't foresee that we're going to be in any way coming up against those restrictions. We're a US-based company, and we don't foresee any Chinese ownership. But we might well be using bits and pieces of the Chinese technology as we progress. Now, as I mentioned initially, our core technological bet, which is also going to be, we think, the long-term future of the company, is 24M semi-solid technology, just developed at MIT. So a full US-based technology stack. There's some really good reasons why we think that technology is attractive at scale, including it's particularly well-suited for the kind of energy storage, grid storage type of applications that we discussed. But of course, if the other team's been beating you for the last 10 years, you wouldn't be very smart if you didn't try to learn their best tricks.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Although I think it speaks to some of the tensions that companies like yours that are making use of this legislation need to are thinking about as you move here, because it seems like there's some uncertainty in terms of, will there be more restrictions? Some lawmakers are not happy to see. They're happy to see these companies opening in the U.S., but they feel like they're also importing Chinese technology and using them. We've seen that in car battery production, and it sounds like the landscape is not fully certain in terms of even those bits and pieces like you're talking about of whether lawmakers will continue to tolerate that or they'll push to make things more restrictive going forward.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good point. And it's going to be important to be thoughtful about it, and it's going to be important to get clarity on it, because obviously markets typically do not like lack of clarity. So the more clarity and the more thoughtfulness, the better. But again, there's probably been a net export of intellectual property going the other way for quite a while. So we could do worse than perhaps accepting some humility and see what we can learn and how we can apply it to build our own capabilities and capacity and competitiveness as soon as possible, as fast as possible.
So back to the Inflation Reduction Act more broadly. I mean, you talked in detail about how this will help your operation, how it motivated you to get set up here in Georgia and change the pace of things. I wonder also more broadly, because obviously this measure is not just about incentivizing particular companies, but also speeding up the pace of the energy transition in the US. And so that being the case, can you talk about the extent to which this package, this legislation, has actually created more fertile ground for you in the US? Does it change your expansion plans or the pace at which you're moving? Does it create more opportunities outside just the direct incentives to your own company?
Yeah, so in our case, we had a plan. It consisted of building a gigafactory here in Norway first and then building one in the US next. And clearly the direct incentives in the IRA changed the landscape more or less overnight. And I would say made us reexamine our plan and draw a different conclusion. So that's why we're there now. We know of, I think we could probably list a dozen other companies that have either made or we know to be making similar considerations. And I guess if you look at it top down, the last number I saw was $268 billion has been redirected. And these are private dollars, not the PTCs that are incentivized, but have been redirected in terms of private investment as a direct consequence of the IRA since its inception.
So final question here. I mean, what you're doing is quite challenging. It involves critical minerals. It involves lots of power at a time the grid is not looking so great. It involves lots of labor. What's the biggest challenge you're facing in getting the operation up and running and moving forward?
Yeah, so collectively, the biggest challenge is also perhaps the biggest opportunity here, which is to transfer the skills to build the capability, the capacity, competitiveness, which involves hundreds and thousands of jobs just in terms of FREYR in the US. And these are jobs that they're not happening in the US right now. These are skills that aren't there yet, but will be. So the collective effort of finding and attracting and training and retaining the talent, the jobs from operator level and all the way up to the postdoc level, and to make sure that we keep that motion way past the expiry of the IRA benefits. That's going to be the biggest challenge we all have here.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Birger Steen, we appreciate you taking the time to join us and sort of explain all these things to us today. And thank you to all of our viewers for joining us, too.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.